Okay, welcome everyone. Today we are taking a really deep dive into the microscopic world. We're looking at material science. Specifically, we want to understand the mechanism that, you know, decides if a metal is super strong, like for a building, or if it's, well, soft enough you could bend it. We're talking about phase transitions, how stuff transforms, right? Like liquid metal turning solid, or even, you know, a solid changing its internal structure, maybe becoming stronger. But our focus, it's that tiny critical first moment. It's called nucleation.
Yeah, so our mission today is to unpack the theory behind nucleation, you know, the textbook models, and then compare that to what actually happens in real materials, which is often messy and involves defects. Understanding this difference, well, it's crucial for engineers designing alloys. We need to get why.
Exactly. Nucleation, it's basically the birth certificate for a new phase within the material. It's that moment when the very first tiny particle, we call it an embryo, forms. But here's the thing. For that tiny embryo to actually survive and grow, it has to get over a significant energy hump, an activation barrier.
An energy barrier? Why? Well, think about it. When you create something new inside something old, you have to create a boundary, an interface between them. And creating that new surface, it costs energy. It's like an initial fee the atoms have to pay. And that cost is what stops things from transforming instantly, even when conditions seem right.
Okay, I think I get it.
Yeah.
So let's start with the standard model, the classical theory. Homogeneous nucleation, right? This assumes the change starts completely randomly, just from atoms jiggling around because of heat. In a perfect material, no flaws.
Precisely. A perfect uniform bulk material. And in this view, for one of these random clusters or embryos to grow, it needs to lower the overall energy of the system, the Gibbs free energy.
Yeah.
But it's a constant battle. There are two forces at play. One is the volume energy. This is favorable. It's the energy released when the atoms arrange into the new, more stable phase. That's your driving force.
Okay, the driving force.
Yeah.
Makes sense. What's battling against it?
The surface energy, that interface cost we just mentioned. That's unfavorable. So the total energy change is always this balance, this tug of war between the volume gain and the surface cost.
And that balance, that leads to critical limits, doesn't it?
Exactly. Two key things emerge. First, there's a critical size. If the embryo is smaller than this size, all dollars, the surface cost wins and it just dissolves back. Only if thermal fluctuations make it larger than dollars does the volume benefit start to dominate, making growth favorable.
And the second thing?
The activation barrier, the dollars. That's the energy peak you have to climb to even reach that critical size. It's the hurdle.
Right, the hurdle. And the theory says that the stronger the push, the driving force, the lower that barrier gets, like it drops quickly.
Yes, it varies inversely with the square of the driving force. So a stronger push makes it much, much easier to get over the hump.
Okay, so if we put all that together, what does it say about the nucleation rate? How fast should these new particles actually form?
Well, the rate, Ivy later, depends on a few things. How often atoms try to form the new structure, how many potential starting spots there are, envelopers, and crucially, the probability of actually clearing that energy barrier, dollar railer. That probability is an exponential term, X-P-E-R-T-R. It's very sensitive.
Okay, here's where it gets interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because when you plug actual numbers into this nice, neat, classical theory,
it kind of falls apart in practice.
Yeah, it predicts something wild. It says you need massive amounts of supercooling to get any significant nucleation happening.
That's right. We're talking hundreds of degrees below the equilibrium temperature. Something like 20% of the absolute melting point, $0.22. It's huge.
But anyone who works with metals knows that's not what happens. Transformations happen much, much easier than that.
Exactly. In the real world, nucleation kicks off with just very slight supercooling, maybe $0.022, often just tens of degrees, not hundreds.
So a tenfold difference. What explains that massive gap between theory and reality?
The answer is simple, and frankly, everywhere. Heterogeneous nucleation.
Heterogeneous, meaning not uniform.
Right. Real materials are full of imperfections. Defects, things like missing atoms, dislocations, boundaries between crystal grains, surfaces, even tiny bits of impurities. And the data is crystal clear. These defects act as preferred nucleation sites. They dramatically lower that activation barrier, the dollars.
Why? How do defects help?
Think of a defect like a dislocation. It already has some strain energy associated with it in the original material. If a nucleus forms right on that defect, it can actually use part of the defect's structure or relieve some of that defect's strain energy.
So the defect gives it a sort of energetic discount.
Exactly. It makes the site favorable. It's cheaper, energetically speaking, to start the new phase there than out in the perfect bulk material. So the barrier for heterogeneous nucleation is way, way lower than the theoretical ball.
That makes intuitive sense. Do we see this experimentally?
Oh, absolutely. There are classic electron microscope images showing, for instance, tiny plates of vanadium carbide forming inside iron. And where do they form? Almost invariably, right along the lines of dislocations, you can see them decorated.
What if you see one that looks like it's floating free? Does that mean homogeneous nucleation happened?
Almost certainly not. Remember, those microscope samples are incredibly thin, maybe 100 nanometers. It's far more likely that the particle nucleated on a defect that's just slightly above or below the thin slice you're looking at.
So defects are just unavoidable, and they dominate.
They really do. They're so pervasive that heterogeneous nucleation is pretty much always the mechanism in play. It's actually quite neat mathematically.
Homogeneous nucleation just becomes a special theoretical case of heterogeneous nucleation. It's the limit you reach when the wetting or contact angle between the nucleus and the supposed defect site is 180 degrees, meaning the defect offers absolutely no energetic help at all.
Wow. So the ideal theory is just the worst case scenario in reality. Pretty much, yeah. And this understanding is critical for engineering. If we want to control how a material transforms, and thus its final properties,
we need to control not just the driving force, but also where the nucleation happens, the sites.
Exactly. Let's talk about that driving force first. The main chemical driving force, delta G hel, it's directly tied to the undercooling.
Undercooling. That's just how far below the equilibrium temperature. Minus the actual temperature, T.
Correct. Delta T, Elise, Te. The bigger that delta T, the more supersaturated the parent phase is, and the stronger the thermodynamic push to form the new phase.
Okay, and this links directly to making materials stronger, because precipitates, these small particles formed by nucleation.
They act like roadblocks.
Right. They get in the way of dislocations moving, which is how metals deform plastically. So more precipitates mean a stronger material.
Precisely. So if you want high strength, you need a high number density and velars of these precipitate particles, lots of them packed closely together.
So how do engineers actually increase envolars? The source material suggests a couple of main ways, building on what we've discussed.
Well, the first is pretty direct. If heterogeneous nucleation on defects is the way to go, why not add more defects?
Like intentionally damage the material a bit first.
Sort of. You can subject the material to plastic deformation, rolling it, forging it before you do the heat treatment that causes precipitation. You're basically preloading it with nucleation sites.
Okay, that's one way. More sites. What's the other lever?
Increase the driving force. That means increasing the undercooling, delta tail.
So make the transformation happen at a lower temperature.
Exactly. A lower temperature means a larger delta T, a bigger chemical push, which generally leads to a higher nucleation rate and thus more particles.
But there's a catch there, isn't there? Getting it cold enough fast enough?
Yes. That's the challenge. You need to cool the material very rapidly, often quenching it, to avoid transformation happening at higher temperatures while you're cooling down. You want to preserve that high driving force until you reach the desired low temperature. It's a kinetic game.
Right, a race against time. And just quickly, this works in reverse too, for dissolving things.
Absolutely analogous. If you want to dissolve those precipitates back into the main phase, just reaching the equilibrium temperature, terity isn't usually enough. You need to superheat it, go above terity to provide the driving force for the reverse transformation. There's that energy barrier again, working both ways.
Okay, so we've got natural defects. We can add defects. But engineers are cleverer than that, right? They add things on purpose during solidification.
They do indeed. This is where nucleating agents or inoculants come in. These are specific particles deliberately added to the liquid metal before it solidifies.
The goal isn't just any nucleation, it's controlled nucleation.
Precisely. The aim is to trigger lots of nucleation events simultaneously throughout the melt. This leads to a final solid with a much smaller, more uniform grain size.
Why is small grain size good?
Smaller grains generally mean higher strength and, very importantly, better toughness. The material's ability to absorb energy without fracturing. Think impact resistance.
Okay, so what makes a good inoculant?
Well, first, it needs to actually survive in the molten metal, so it generally needs a higher melting point. And then it needs to be effective at promoting nucleation on its surface. This might be because its crystal lattice structure is a good match for the solidifying metal, or perhaps there's a favorable local chemical reaction at the interface.
Let's make this real. The sources give some great examples. Welding, for instance.
Ah, yes, a classic case. In a standard weld pool, solidification usually starts at the cooler edges and grows inwards. This often results in large columnar grains pointing towards the center. This structure can be weak, and it also interferes with things like ultrasonic testing, making it hard to check the weld quality non-destructively.
So how do you fix it?
You inoculate. You add tiny particles, for example, tantalum nitride, TAN, into the weld filler material.
And what happens?
It's a dramatic change. Instead of those big columns, the 10 particles trigger nucleation throughout the liquid simultaneously. You end up with a much finer, more uniform, isotropic grain structure, much better properties, much easier to inspect.
That's a neat trick. What's another example?
High-speed steels. These are amazing materials used for cutting tools, drills, things that get very hot and see a lot of wear.
Okay.
Their performance relies heavily on their microstructure, which includes very hard carbide particles. Our sources mention that adding tungsten carbide, WC particles, as an inoculant to the initial liquid melt significantly refines the structure of these steels.
Leading to better tools.
Exactly. Outstanding wear resistance, holds its hardness at high temperatures, all thanks to controlling that initial solidification via inoculation.
Got it. Now, there was a subtle point mentioned about fragments. Sometimes bits just break off.
Ah, yes. In a turbulent liquid, bits of the solid that have already formed can sometimes break off and get swirled around. These fragments can then act as centers for new crystal growth. But technically, since these fragments are usually already larger than the critical nucleus size, Lutterdahlers, we don't strictly call this nucleation. It's more like seeding growth from pre-existing stable bits. A slight distinction, but important conceptually.
Okay, that clarifies things. So wrapping this deep dive up, the big takeaway seems clear. The way materials transform isn't really governed by pure random chance, like that old homogeneous theory suggested.
Not in the real world, no. It's dominated by imperfections. Heterogeneous nucleation on defects is the rule.
And understanding that allows engineers to move beyond just accepting material properties and start actively designing them right from that first nucleation step.
Absolutely. Whether it's dealing with existing defects, creating more defects, or adding specific inoculants, it all comes down to manipulating these energy-favorable starting points. That's how we control the microstructure and ultimately the strength, toughness, and performance of everything from welds to advanced tools.
A transformation truly driven by, well, imperfections. It's fascinating.
It really is. And, just to leave you with something to think about, we've focused intensely on getting that first nucleus formed, the rate of nucleation. But if your job was to predict the total amount of transformed material over time, the final volume fraction at a given temperature, what else would you need to consider after nucleation has happened?
Okay, so the particles have formed. What next?
Think about it. They don't just sit there, they need to grow. And particles growing from different places might run into each other.
Growth rate and interference.
Exactly. You'd need theories for particle growth rates, and you'd need to account for how these growing regions eventually impinge on one another, both when they physically collide and even when their diffusion fields start to overlap before they touch. That's the next layer of complexity, something to ponder.